Hello and welcome to the Minds on the Frontline podcast, brought to you by the Frontline Strong Together 5 program. FSD 5 provides streamlined access to behavioral and mental health services, as well as crisis resources for Michigan's Frontline 5 workers and their families. This includes all professional, part-time, and volunteer firefighters, EMS, law enforcement, corrections officers, and 911 dispatchers in Michigan and their immediate family members. First responders and mental health experts collaboratively created FST 5 to provide 24/7 live support, effective resources, and cutting-edge services to prevent and alleviate PTSD, anxiety, depression, and other frontline work-related mental and behavioral health challenges. Need help now? If you are a frontline worker in Michigan or an immediate family member experiencing any crisis, work-related, substance abuse, depression, relationships, finances, or any other, reach out by calling 1-833-34-STRONG or go to fst5.org for more information. I'm Jeff Lassers, one of the hosts of the Minds on the Frontline podcast, and I'm a professional firefighter, paramedic, educator, and content creator. Minds on the Frontline is co-hosted by Mike Mattern, who is also a professional firefighter and paramedic. In addition, Mike is a peer support team member for his fire department and the Frontline Strong Together 5 program, as well as the chair of the Michigan Professional Firefighters Union Behavioral Health Committee, and a board member of the Michigan Crisis Response Association. Mike has training and experience with frontline worker mental and behavioral health. On the other hand, I do not. My role is to produce the show, whereas Mike is our resident subject matter expert. Together, we hope to inform, educate, and entertain frontline workers, their families, and the public regarding the realities of frontline work-related mental and behavioral health challenges. In today's episode, we are incredibly honored to welcome Anthony Gonzo Gonzalez to the show. Gonzo is the Coral Springs Parkland Fire Department Battalion Chief assigned to the Training Division. Gonzo's journey with the city began in 1995, first serving as a volunteer before going full-time in 2000. Gonzo is a producer for the Gettin' Salty Experience podcast, which is a fantastic and hugely popular show hosted by retired FDNY firefighters that share their stories and traditions from their days in the fire service. Gonzo was at the forefront of one of the most challenging situations faced by first responders, the harrowing Parkland shooting at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School on February 14, 2018. This incident was particularly difficult as his daughter was a student in the building during the event. Thankfully, she was unharmed, although her boyfriend was sadly among the 17 lives lost. Gonzo's profound experiences and insights are not only vast, but also deeply impactful, offering a unique perspective on the heavy responsibilities borne by those who respond to crises. While we're not here to relive the events of the day of the Parkland shooting, we've invited Gonzo to share his insights into what first responder agencies, and indeed all of us, need to be ready for in the face of such devastating circumstances. The importance of preparation cannot be overstated, both in dealing with the immediate aftermath and in supporting the long-term mental and behavioral health needs of those who face the unthinkable in the line of duty. Gonzo's experience will guide us through the critical discussions on readiness, response, and resilience that can help shape a path forward from trauma to healing. Please check us out on YouTube, Instagram, and Facebook, and make sure to like and subscribe to all Minds on the Frontline podcast social media channels. Thank you, and enjoy the show. Good afternoon, gentlemen.
What's going on?
What's going on?
Oh, we're here at FDIC Indianapolis. We have a guest here today. Would you go ahead and tell everybody who you are, what you do, and where you do it?
Well, welcome. Thank you for having me. My name is Anthony Gonzalez. I am the Battalion Chief of Training or in Training with the Coral Springs Parkland Fire Department down in South Florida, Broward County.
Right on. You don't have an accent of somebody who's from Broward County. I've met a lot of people from Broward County.
I tell everybody that that's the sixth borough. You know, we were relocated somewhere in the state of Florida. We have groups of people that are from what we call relocated.
Yeah.
So we just add the extra borough to us. That's what I like to say anyway.
So you have a nuanced perspective we wanted to tap into today.
Okay.
You were involved at a pretty infamous
situation, the Parkland shooting.
Yes.
And so that has led you to be kind of a public figure in a lot of ways, of speaking on somebody who had to respond to that, as well as being the parent of somebody who was inside of that building. And in partnership with your daughter, you guys have gone on to do some amazing things to speak about this event and all the things that go with it. So before we really get into it, why don't you give everybody an overview of the situation from your perspective? We could all Google it, look at the news clips, what happened. It's pretty obvious. But give us the overview of what happened from a guy who had to be on the truck going there that day.
I've had this conversation a couple of times, so I usually start off with saying that it starts out, for any of us in the job, it's kind of like a normal day. Beautiful day, hanging out kind of thing, just doing our normal routine. And I also say that I wasn't even supposed to be in the seat that I was in that day. So I was actually filling in as what we call step-up battalion chief that day. We do physicals every year, life scan. So it was just coming to the end of that. I was actually putting my pants on. I actually had put my radio strap on and turned my radio back up so I can hear it. And then the call dropped. I've been around where we've heard had a couple of threats in the past. So when I heard it come through, it was kind of like a double take. I say, I'm like, oh, shooting at Douglas. Okay. You know, there have been some threats before, so it turned pretty quickly that it seemed to be the real thing. But, you know, again, initially my thought was like, oh, this is not real. Then it became real, and where I was getting my physical, I was literally 2 to 3 minutes away from the school. So I jumped in my truck at the time, and I hauled ass over there. And, you know,
you're on duty.
I'm on duty.
You're in a department vehicle.
In a
position of like a battalion chief.
Battalion chief is a shift commander at the time, or running the shift. And it was two battalion chiefs that are on normally that day. And I actually happened to arrive behind my deputy chief at the time. It was a second chief on scene. It was like an eerie silence when you pulled up because there wasn't cars on the road. It was definitely an eerie feeling. You know, so many things are going through your mind. And I will say that the initial thought of my daughter was there and gone. You know, I guess you can say there's a little bit of, I don't want to say survivor's guilt, but there's a little like, well, I quickly put my job first before my family, you know. And, you know, some people commend that, saying it's a professional thing to do, but I still kind of, I don't want to say I beat myself up over it. It kind of goes through my mind a little bit. So we're 10 minutes into the scene as we're trying to get things laid out, maybe 15. Again, it's kind of hard to ballpark the actual time frame because it was kind of chaotic and kids running and trying to console people while we're trying to set up a command post and those kind of things. And I stopped myself and I said, oh, shit. Pardon my French. I said, my kid's in the school. You know, with that, my phone had blown up because it had gone news. So it must have been maybe 15 minutes because people were from out of state were texting me, I hope you're okay, the whole thing. And I didn't answer them. So I scrolled to my wife. I says, you know, where's Tori? I haven't heard from her. A few minutes later goes by as we're still trying to do things. I come back to it. And she says she's okay. She had actually gone to the neighborhood Walmart where the suspect ended up actually going as well. And we picked her up over there. My wife picked her up over there. And she had said she's okay and that she couldn't find her boyfriend. So at that time, victims were starting to come out. And it took me a little while. We started doing what we're doing, but I still had that plan in my mind. You know, because I was getting information that there were several victims. It was a little off from what the news was saying. Initial reports were 3 or 4 were deceased, and I had different information that were saying a lot more than that, obviously before the final number came out. But where I was the what we call the casualty collection point, where they bring all the victims. So PD was bringing people out. Kids were coming up to us and obviously transporting people out of there. So, again, it's a kind of hard. You can't paint the picture of how chaotic something like that can be and try to process everything. There was a couple of times where I just feel like in a movie and they take a camera angle and you just spin around you and you're standing there by yourself. That's kind of what I tell people what it was like, you know, with people coming in, trying to console students, trying to stop parents from running to the school. It was a constant juggle, and I was supposed to actually be in charge of where I was, the accountability officer. I was supposed to be in charge of the units that were there, where were the people were going. And again, so you can imagine trying to juggle at the same time initially with my kid and trying to find out where her boyfriend was. Ultimately, her boyfriend was one of the 17 that were killed. So that's a whole nother dynamic that people don't realize that you have to process too. So I don't know if I'm getting off a little bit, but you can just imagine how the scene just kept unfolding. And it was good like that for a while, between transporting people and, you know, the chaos happened for a while. Again, I can't put numbers to certain things because some things are a blur.
Sure.
You know? Yeah, I think so. It's one of those things where, I mean, that's the mind is only able to process so much at one time. And you pull up in the middle of this and you've got multi-factors going on, you know, school shooting going on. Where's your daughter? Where's your daughter's boyfriend? I mean, the mind can only process so much at one thing. And we've all been on those scenes where you get overwhelmed and you just sit there for like,
That's what I was explaining.
Like, yeah, the first couple seconds, like, you're like,
"That's just in where," because it was just, I don't, you don't know where to go. Yeah. What to do. It gives me just chills even thinking about it right now as I'm explaining it to you.
You're taking in all this information and like the worst day imaginable type situation. It's almost like your brain went into that old, you do what you're trained to do. Mm-hmm. And so the only thing you were trained to do in this situation was to do your job, to go in, treat people, right? So it's almost like your brain's like, yes, I acknowledge my daughter is in here, but this is what I know what to do right now, mm-hmm. right? So it's like you were forced into what you were trained for. Which speaks to my next question. Do you feel like any amount of training could have prepared you for just the intensity of the number of things that have to happen all right now? Like you said, any initial action plan showing up on that, you're supposed to establish communications, establish incident command, assign this, assign that. And meanwhile, people are screaming, running around, running in and out of buildings. Did you feel prepared for that incident in any way?
I would say I would... slightly prepared, but there's only so much training can cover when it comes down to the real deal with anything with what we do. It does help. We were very proactive department for many years, and we actually trained in this field prior to this shooting taking place. And so I think that that helped us. You know, some other agencies didn't respond so well because they didn't train that way. And I'm not shooting them down. Just some our agency was a little more proactive in that field. So. Again, as I said, training can only do so much, but to prepare you for that mentally, no way. That's too much, as we just already said. That's just too much to process to try to have. Some people are good at it, and some of the guys I was watching, but you could just see how overwhelmed they were in their tasks as well, probably just because of the magnitude of the incident. You know, not knowing where we actually staged, where he actually was shooting out the window because he was going to shoot at us. You know, that was his plan. Well, again, these are all things that come after the fact mm-hmm. that you realize, you're like, oh, wow, we were kind of in a bad spot. And then eventually we brought some units in to give us protection, but that plays in your mind too. And I know it's a little off script or a little bit off the thing for training wise, but you know, the long and the short of it is, I would say it helped a little bit percentage wise. Maybe I don't want to insult anybody, but maybe, you know, 30 or 40% that could help you.
So you talked about, you know, after the response, you had a huge response when it came to mental health and peer support. What kind of programs did you have prior to the shooting that were able to respond that day?
I think back then, prior to the shooting, we had, your standard team that would be called in for a tragic event, infant death or something like that, for your team. So that was the norm. But since the shooting, our division has grown. We have a health and safety battalion that's in charge of the city. We have a battalion, but we have a district chief or a division chief that oversees the entire mental health and battalion health and safety for the entire city now. That's what's grown immensely since then. So he is in charge of all these little elements, our clinicians, peer support, obviously the health and safety of our membership and as well as the city. But obviously for the department, now we have our health and safety battalion that takes that. So he's encompassed a lot of the stuff, like I said, the clinicians, the peer support, and under the umbrella of BHAP, which is skipping my mind right now is what the actual definition is, but all those programs fall underneath this policy. So it's, again, it continues to grow as things go on. The biggest push right now is obviously cancer, stuff like that. But, you know, when they have the ability to do mental health with our clinicians, peer support, and all the services that we would provide, we bring them out. You know, 2018 was a shitty year. So I seen it kind of come full circle. A lot of people come out because that was the year we had the shooting. One of my drivers was our first suicide. Mm. And then I was actually deployed to Hurricane Michael, which is on the west coast of Florida in the Pensacola area, where the devastation was there. So coming out and seeing people come together for all those divisions, not just with us, other people coming out, and it was nice to see that people growing and changing the culture of mental health and things like that. That's, I know at the grand of it, that's what these podcasts or these discussions, they need to happen. They need to happen more because I tell you, almost 30 years on the job with almost 10 more to go that... I feel it's changing. I feel people such as yourself are making an impact. Just keeping that, having that conversation, getting people like me to have and tell people it's okay. This is going to sound cliche, but it's okay not to be okay. It's real. So, and I know I went off script a little bit there. I keep saying that. I'm sorry, but it's important. I wanted the audience to know that, you know, don't be afraid to speak up. It makes a difference.
So a lot of people have a problem speaking up. And so sometimes we got to put systems in place to check on people. Not force them to speak up, to give them like an ultra safe place for them to be expected to speak up if they need that. So do you think that there needs to be more of a fortified system that looks at how we respond to these incidents afterwards?
I think they're actually changing with that. And we're starting to see that. As I said earlier, I'm a member of the Urban Search and Rescue Team, and we had the Surfside building collapse. And even recently, the hurricane that I was deployed onto the West Coast again last year, they're starting to now mobilize mental health units to go with us. So I think that that's where the structure where your question is going to come in, or it's going to eventually be answered, where it's going to be routine. If it isn't for the most part already, that when something happens, you're going to have a team of people that are going to be there to help everybody and anybody that needs that kind of help. So I'm saying, so it was pretty significant for the Surfside building collapse when they had that down there, to have the peer support people there, because there were some people still struggling from seeing what they had seen that day as well.
So based on those experiences that you've been a part of, and you know, secondary and primary, what are the common things that you're seeing that need to be set up? Like, how soon after these incidents are we should be pulling people off the road? Like, what does it look like exactly? Like, we keep saying, yeah, we call them, we make sure they're okay. But in your opinion, you know, you're the chief of the America Fire Department.
Yeah.
What's your rule?
Well, if it was up to me, I would stick with our standard, what we normally do after an incident. We bring everybody in, we have the debriefing, you know, and then see if there's somebody that's struggling. I did notice that we had some people that didn't want to speak even after the shooting 6 years ago. You know, I'm okay, being a tough guy. That's where I felt, and again, I'll mention this, is the conversations that I did have. Now, I didn't speak to a lot of people. I wasn't afraid to have the conversation with anybody that would ask me about how I was doing. I wasn't afraid to speak about it. You know, I just wanted to get that out there, and I think that caught on. I think we helped some people. And when I did a few other podcasts, I know that same kind of conversation, just having that conversation, making that statement that, just have a conversation with me, how you doing? Let's just talk about it. And it helped some people. I didn't push it on people, but that's something that I think that without pushing people into a corner, you just kind of wait for that right opportune time to get in and have that conversation. But initially, let's have a gathering and see if we can identify some people that we may want to follow back up with. I mean, hopefully that answers your question, or kind of steers down the direction that we want to go.
Because it's, even though we're not professional mental health providers, we know the people we work with. Mm-hmm. Usually more than most professions, mm-hmm. because we're spending so much dang time with each other, right? We're the ones with the best radars. We're not always the best to help, though, mm-hmm. right? Because sometimes we don't know what to say. We're always those first ones to say, let me know what you need from me. Oh, I'd be happy to help. We just have no clue what that looks like sometimes. What is the value, and are you guys using culturally competent clinicians in these processes?
I would say yes. I know some of them have to be trained. They go through a pretty decent program from what I've seen. I haven't been involved in it. I've seen some experiences with it, shall I say. I don't want to say I haven't seen it all, but some of them that I've actually had some conversation with seem like they're very interested and they want to help, and they're there for the right reasons. Now, this is a little bit different because my daughter still had a year left at the school after the shooting, and there was a clear difference between people that were there that were not experienced or had the right way to ask somebody for help. So I unfortunately got to see that side of it from her perspective, and the way she would come home and tell me the pretty much blunt kind of conversation. Well, what's wrong with you? Bothering you? Very kind of cold, not a really proper way to approach somebody that is just, especially with her. I mean, I say her because obviously that's what I know the best, but in that situation, but even a family member that lost a child, you know, that was the wrong approach. I say our team is doing a good job preparing and trying to stay on top of it to continually improve themselves.
Yeah. One of the things that was so notable in the interview that you and your daughter did for the Behind the Shield podcast was she brought up the fact that it didn't feel as if the clinicians in that situation, it was like they didn't understand what they were supposed to do, but it's so fundamental what they need to do. Mm-hmm. And it was very, like you said, blunt, dry, sterile. Are you feeling triggered? Well, do you think you're triggered because of this?
Exactly.
Hang on. Why are you leading me into any approach. Of this?
Yeah.
And to hear a young person articulate that, who went through it, and now, like you said, she's 23 now, and I believe that interview was just earlier this year.
It was a little while ago, actually.
Yeah, okay, so within the last year. And she's able to look back on that and be like, you could tell in her voice, like, seriously? This is what you're asking me? Do you know what I just did?
It was not helpful for her. I mean, it's where we're very different, as you mentioned. She's 10 years or light years ahead of me when she comes to speaking and carrying herself and the way she digests certain things and could put me to shame. I wish I had half of her speaking ability. She blows my mind away.
I'm just kidding.
No. I wish I could speak like she does. I try my best. I definitely look up to her speaking that way. But anyway.
You should be proud. She did a very nice job.
And I've gotten a lot of that because she can, as you said, she can articulate her mind very well when it comes to this. And unfortunately, she was forced to grow up pretty quickly.
Yeah.
You know, and handle something that most people shouldn't, you know, nobody should really have to handle that. But, you know, that's unfortunate what we have in our society today.
So certainly all industries suffer and benefit from good and bad clinicians that are out there. What other things do fire departments and the first responder community in general, because dispatchers are taking these calls. That's got to be tough when you're hearing a school shooting. Cops are certainly showing up to go get the bad guy. They go get the bad guy. We take care of the wounded, and then we keep moving on. The corrections officers certainly aren't a part of this, but EMS is going to be as well. This is really going across almost all five disciplines. What do they really need to be prepared for? Not just administratively, like just talk to the guys and the girls that are going on these calls and taking these calls.
I don't know if you can ever fully prepare for something like that, even through training or whatnot. The magnitude of that day was, like I said, I've been involved in this field since I'm 18 years old. So it's almost 30 years, and I've done a lot of stuff. I'm not saying that we've done a crap ton of stuff, but I've done some stuff the training has helped me. I've been prepared for, but I don't think enough training could prepare you for something of this magnitude. You could try even from the mental health side of it. It just seems you're going to see that you have never seen before.
Sure,
you know. If you talk about war and these kind of things that are taking place, that exposure, I don't know if you can ever really find a solution to something like that. I really don't know.
So knowing that, what do you recommend? Like, there's no 100% solution. So how do we reconcile that? Like, we still have to train.
Yeah.
We have to make some type of tactical impact on this. Because then, doing nothing's not an option.
I would just say, as far as training, trying to stay as mentally fit as you can, whatever that method is for you, whether it's not afraid to have conversations on a regular basis. You're on a pediatric code. I was fortunate enough, again, another little story, but that 20 some odd years on the job, I never had to work a child. My youngest child I ever had to work was 9. Before I got promoted, I had to work I want to say it was 6 or 8 month old child. So that's something that you cannot really prepare for, but you could be better at it, but you know, you got to find some tools to find comfort in things. I'm not really sure of some things aren't coming to me. They'll probably come to me as we go a little bit later, but whether it's yoga or just getting out and enjoying life, hanging out with some friends, having a conversation, that's where I was going with that. I got my thoughts back. I talked a little bit about that. Say, hey, this is my first one in over 20 years on the job, 20 something years on the job. So I felt that helped me. You know, not being afraid, not being closed off, being open with how you feel. I think people, if they can do that more, I think that's going to be helpful for them just in themselves. And then use whatever tools your agency provides for you, whether it's clinician, whether it's some extra time off, which we were good about that. You take all the time you need. If you need a couple shifts off, 3-4 shifts off, take it. We're still kind of learning with that thing too. What's going to work? What are we going to get out of this? What can we do better going down the road? Which, like I said, those other programs that we mentioned, we've added to that. And maybe something else will come to me in a little while, but I hope I got what you were looking for.
No, absolutely.
And I know you talked about peer support and how big that was in the whole grand scheme of things. What kind of value do you see in, you know, everybody says, all right, well, let's call in the peer support team. Let's do peer support, whatever. But the value of just being a peer, like nobody's ever going to understand what you guys went through that day, except for the other people who were on that scene. Where's, in your mind, the value of just having those people who are on that scene talk to one another?
That's what I was saying. For me, having somebody that is related, the pediatric one or the shooting, whatever your tragic event is, that connection between you and somebody else that is experiencing the same thing, just having that conversation, don't bottle it up. You know, I think it helps just getting a little bit off your chest.
Even and you if don't have to be somebody, a peer to do it.
You don't have to be a peer. Exactly peer what you're supporter. Saying. Peers, you yes. and me right now, or the yes. three of us here.
Exactly. You don't have to be on the peer support team to do those things. Yes, yeah. That's what I was getting at.
And I want to say peer support because now we have actually people that are part of a group, a peer support group. And yeah, you're 100% right as far as that. That's what I was relating to is just not being afraid to have that conversation if you're just whoever was willing to listen.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because not everybody wants to listen to that kind of stuff. And for a little while, I was noticing it because people would ask and I would get on and I would just kind of go on a little bit longer because I didn't want to keep a bottle up. Somebody wants to listen. You know, I want to get it off my chest. I don't want to keep it going. I mean, I didn't really burden my wife with it. I'm, you know, like most people, we don't bring our, too much of our stuff home from work. But being in our unique situation, we've had some conversation about limited, you know, but it was some conversation which I felt the helpful. That's the, so the value in that, is to answer your question, I'm sorry, is just not being afraid to have that conversation with somebody that's experienced something.
And do you think the benefit of maybe fostering that to be culturally acceptable allows for us to get it out before it's even a problem? Because what we talked about with Crystal last time, Crystal Little, shout out, she's with Palm Beach County Fire Rescue, and she talks about how unexpressed emotions are just going to swirl around in there. They don't go anywhere. You have to get them out somehow. And so especially after incidents of any magnitude that are in your head, if they're in here, you should probably talk about them. Even if it's a low impact call that may not seem like it should be impacting you.
But I think that starts at your level. Like it starts like where I'm at as a captain. It starts with me at my house. Like when we come back from a run, I'll be the first one who says, wow, that was a tough run. That was a shitty run. Then that makes it okay for that. Now your crew to be like, yeah, you know what it was, you know, cause we all try to put up that front. Like, hey, it didn't bother me. We want to look like the tough guy, whatever. But I think it really starts at that level as a leader, as an officer, whatever, in your, wherever you are. I think if you make it okay for that little bit, that spreads at some point, because you're teaching now your junior members how to be officers. So when they see that as a newer person, whatever, and they look at you and you're, you know, the captain of the station, you're like, yeah, that really bothered me a little bit. That's how you change the culture behind all of this, is you're teaching them how to be that leader who takes care of the people on their crew.
Yeah, we do what we're taught. Yes. We're all by example.
It's all passing on knowledge. Yeah, that's what I mean. That's what this whole thing is built on.
Yeah.
And it's good to set those expectations as a company officer that can do that, to set that expectation. You create that environment in your firehouse, and it just spreads. Cat passes on that this is Captain So and So. He operates this way. Yeah, if it works, and they get used to it, well, and it's you're changing that mentality just by. And I think you're 100% right. It does start at the lower levels, and especially now, is to keep the conversation going and building that expectation of that. Hey, listen, we're gonna have a serious call, and we're gonna at some point. It may not be immediately after the call, but at some point, we're gonna have a conversation about this call, because you use it as a training thing. You're gonna talk about it from a training perspective, and you get them to open up a little better, and as we talked about already, the value in having these conversations, because you're going to learn from it. You add a little training element. It's not a trick, but you add a little training side of it, and you know, how you feel about it, what we do. You know, you can kind of introduce that, let the guard down, and have the conversation.
Yeah, and I think it also there's a lot of people out there who think their department just doesn't care about them. You know what I mean? Yeah. And I think it's one of those things where you look at it and you're like, you're not working for me. You're working with me, and I give a shit about you. Well, you know what I mean? It humanizes that we're humans first before we're anything else.
Right.
And I think that makes that connection. And you know, I've seen, and I'm sure you have, you've seen the change in mental health in the past, like 5 years. It's really kind of made a turn. But one of the things I wanted to ask you about is, you know, we're, what, 6 years
six
out
years
now?
Transition, yeah.
I know some of the stuff that we've done with peer support. At the initial incident, everybody floods it with, you know, what can I do for you? Whatever. There's two thoughts. There's one, you know, you don't kind of follow up with people because you don't want to keep bringing it up. Or what we do is we still follow up. What's your thought process? Having going through this, is it don't keep bringing it up? Or do you think there's a value in saying, you know, even now 6 years out, those members who are there amongst yourselves, how are you doing? That type of thing. Or is it, I guess, what's your thought process on it?
We still have some conversations with some of the people. I don't bring it up, only because it's what I've tried to do myself, is to help myself heal and other people heal. Is I just try to limit the information that, because obviously these things still happen, and that's one of the questions that people do ask me, that when it does happen, how do you process it? And I just try to limit the information that I'm taking in, because I drive past the school. I live right by the school, so I have enough reminders of what took place that day. And when I see certain members that I can remember seeing that day, it's just, there's an instant connection there. But I do watch. If it's for me, I may just take a back seat on somebody and just kind of see how they're doing, see how their work habits are, and paying attention. And if I need to interject, then I will. And I've asked some people, hey man, how you doing? Everything going okay? You know, I don't, there's only, you know, a handful of people that ask me how I'm doing pretty regularly when I see them. It's almost one of those things. How are you doing? How's your daughter doing? You know, you can see that that's genuine. So there's still people that feel, even to this day, that they want to ask about it. And I appreciate that. And that's good, because they care. They still want to make sure everybody's doing okay. So I kind of do the same thing. But I don't want to, knowing your people, as we said before, there's some people that don't want to be bothered. You know, they're doing okay. They're doing good. And I can, you know, I can see that, which this is kind of a, that's maybe a double-edged sword, because as I said, the first year or the 2018, when we had the first firefighter suicide, nobody saw the warning signs. Cause no, you know, this is a whole, probably another conversation, and I kind of change a trajectory.
No, keep going. We love, no, this, keep going. It's all as, related.
Is this is that, the whole isolated bunk rooms in the firehouse has, you know, people can go hide. So that's, I think that ties into a little bit, because had he been with us regularly and not been able to go hide, we might have recognized that something was going on. And he was a solid guy. He was a driver for me for a little while, and I taught with him for many years as an instructor for the fire academy. And I didn't think that anything was going on that day happened. I didn't recognize. And unfortunately, that's a whole another element to the importance of mental health and getting the help that we need, because firefighter or first responder suicide is I'll say, off the chain, unfortunately. And it's just, it's a sad thing. So I still, going back to that, having that conversation, those follow-up questions are important. So I hope I answered your question.
No, I,
no,
you're doing amazing.
Yeah, yes. It's all coming down to what I'm getting from you is open lines of communication and just constantly saying, this is what I went on, this is what I feel. And there's no right answer there. It's just, what do I feel? Instead of letting that loop in your mind and in your gut and just swirl around, getting it out, it sounds like, is the best, easiest medicine afterwards. That's just cheap and easy to get it out, because the buildup creates the isolation. The isolation compounds the problems in your mind and your heart. And then you could go down a dark road. So you mentioned your colleague that committed suicide was showing isolating signs. They could have been in events that contributed to this. Unfortunately, first responders are humans that have normal lives, and normal lives come normal problems. And those are heavy. And then on top of that, we go to work and we see three people's worst days before noon. And it gets even harder. So it's sometimes it's not even the calls that we go on. It's whatever's going on in our life that are compounded by the calls that we go on, or the situation we're in. So what I'm getting from this conversation is just have really good relationships and conversations with the people you work with. And if you don't have those good relationships, or if you feel like you can't have those conversations, we got to do something to chip that away. And I think that's the magic right there, is getting people empowered to not let anybody stay in the hole, to get in there and having people to say, no, no, let me show you the way out.
Jump in the hole with them. Jump in and show them the way out. 100%. I think you're hitting the key element, is getting to know the people that you work with.
And it's so easy to not do that too.
Absolutely.
It sounds weird. But it's easy just to do your job. It's easy just to go on calls. I got paperwork. I got this. Then you get hot on the phone. You talk to your kids. But you can ignore everybody. And you could stay away and avoid everything.
But that's still real. That happens to this day. You know, it's just, you know, that routine. So it's hard to break that change. But, you know, in the long and the short of it, I think there's been many advances in what we're doing. I say here we doing now, keeping the conversation going to just draw the attention to it. Where, you know, years ago, it wasn't like, you know, kind of do your thing. I'll check in with you every couple of days. You know, maybe a couple of months down the road, where now it's a lot more accepted.
Could you,
did you say accepted?
Accepted, absolutely. So I was just going to say, would you, so when I got hired, if I walked in the fire station and said, you know, guys, I've been going to therapy. There probably wouldn't be any direct make fun of, but it would be, they would just look at you, right? Because they'll be like, you okay, right? And now it's like, oh, did you have a good session? It's at that point now.
You can have, which I never thought would happen, you can have a kitchen table conversation about a therapist.
Yeah.
And I've seen it happen.
I'm talking about this, and it turns out I'm angry about, like, I've watched people say, you know, I was talking to my therapist, and it turns out I had, like, a really angry look at something, and it comes from, I never thought I'd see all the, you know, we're chimpanzees banging on pots in the kitchen. And now everybody's talking about their feelings? What happened here? Yeah. But that's a good thing. We're headed in a great direction.
Yeah, for sure.
And I think the lagging part you're bringing up is that the only, not the only, but a lot of the people that lag behind or just aren't getting talked to, or we're not dragging them into conversation sometimes.
It might be the personality, or you're reading the person very well and they're like, okay, I'm not going to, you know, it's a chance. You're taking a chance by maybe not engaging and just giving them their space, because some people have to come around when they're ready, you know, and I think that's part of it too, is just give people the time, as long as it's not a detriment to any, you know, further outcome, but somebody that still stays engaged and doesn't forget this person. So that person becomes even more isolated. Like, not one person's reached out to me in a month or 2 months. And that just drives that thought process even further and further in there.
And that happens.
Yeah. Well, and when I was going through some stuff, I wanted to talk about it, but it was under the old regime of you don't say anything, you keep your mouth shut. Like, but I didn't know how to start that conversation. And I think that sometimes the people who are going through stuff don't necessarily know how to come out and say that. But if somebody comes up and goes, hey, I've been noticing, you know, this, and this, you all right? That, I think, allows them to start having that conversation. Like, yeah, you know, I'm not doing good.
Allows license for it.
Yes. But I don't think they know how to verbalize it. Yeah. They want to talk about it, but they don't know how to get that thing started.
I was just going to say, some people that can't have that, I was afraid to ask that question. Yes. I could see it, but how do I approach this guy?
Well, that's the thing. That's the other thing, is they're afraid to have that conversation. And I think it's just as simple as what you talked about. Hey, how you doing? How are things going? You know, I've noticed this. You know, you've been in your bunk room a lot. What's going on here? You know? And I think that just opens it up. It's okay to talk about it at that point. You don't have to get into anything other than, hey, how are you doing? I know you're going through a lot of stuff right now. I think that really opens up that door for people, you know? Mm-hmm. But I think the other half of it is guys like you who have some time on, who people, whether you think so or not, look up to you. You got some time on. You're the, you know, the senior guys or the officers, the captains, whatever. But I think when you talk about it and make it okay to talk about things, it opens up a whole new world, because everybody wants to look tough for you. Mm-hmm. You know, they don't want to show you any weakness. But if you're going, hey, it's cool if you got something going. And I think that's why I love the fact that you were able to come on here, is to have that conversation and show, you know, you said you had 30 years on?
Almost 30 years.
Almost 30 years.
Well, I started when I'm 18. I'm 51 now, so just do the math.
Doesn't look a day over 40. Look at that hair. I don't know. But I think that's what helps. I mean, I think it helps to those types of guys are coming on and going, hey, it's cool. You know, talk to somebody. It's okay to not be okay. You know, I think that's what moves this whole thing forward that we never had for so many years. You know, that's what changes the culture.
If somebody's reaching out or having conversations, one thing that this shooting has a related experience-wise, or actually maybe just over my career, was that if you're going to get more of a response from somebody that's involved in that same incident than somebody that is not, whether it's in this case for the shooting, whether it's a student or a faculty member, or in this case for us, a first responder that was there, this easy for somebody to forget. We don't want to say you never forget 9/11, the whole thing. The unfortunate side of it is, depending on your level of involvement in any tragedy, is going to dictate how involved you are mentally, physically, the whole thing, in those things as you carry on through the rest of your career. I hope that makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely.
Where I was going with that, because I've seen that firsthand from people that just have forgot about the shooting. You know, I say even 9/11, it's because...
Unfortunately, there's been more.
Well, it makes it hard.
You get, oh, was that the one where... No, like, you literally are confusing school shootings now because there's enough of them.
Yeah, it's unfortunately, yeah.
You know, was that the Parkland or was that Uvalde? Was that Sandy
Hook?
It's
even happening out
of
the States now.
Right.
It's all over now.
It's not just the United States anymore.
Okay, so we covered a lot today. I highly recommend that people watch your documentary After Parkland that you and your daughter are a big part of.
Yeah, so that'll give people a side of the... And I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you. It's the family side of things. You know, it's not so much the in-your-face documentary. So it just kind of paints a picture. They follow... It's mostly about my kid a little bit and how... The challenges she had, because that was her soulmate. You know, there was a lot of love there, and you know, that's just that's a very difficult thing for me to speak about. I had a lot of trouble, even as I get a little choked up now thinking about it. It was just, the pain was so deep.
So, as a dad, as a person who responded to that call, and like most firefighters who are in a leadership management position, you care about the people that work for you. Yeah, you know, you worry about the people that don't even work for you yet, I'm sure. The next generation after you leave.
Well, that's what I was going to mention that too. We're hiring people, and part of the things we tell them is that conversation. You're going to see some crap over the years. Just don't be afraid to have the conversation. And we don't beat them up with it. From day one, you're just going to plant that seed. Sorry, I didn't mean
that. Yeah, absolutely. That's awesome.
And knowing that, and being in the situations you've had and the experiences that you've had, and close to administration, you have the ear of administration. Let's pretend you have all of the ears of administration right now. What do our city officials, chiefs, all the leaders, the bosses need to really take home and understand from this?
In a nutshell, they would have to be committed to long-term care for somebody, long-term involvement. Training is going to come. We're going to continue to train. Again, I just did training last year. from the rescue task force element of it, but for the training aspect of it, which I'm involved with, is to do that. And just to, again, it's an investment. They have to invest in our people and not just wait 6 months down the road, you're okay. I mean, circle back at some point and it, you know, follow up. What we like to use in our fire department is follow up, follow through.
You know, I like that.
You know, and you have to stay on top of it. Whether it's 6 months, 8 months down the road, and this goes for everybody, the school board, whoever is involved needs to have that commitment to our people to make sure that they're getting the help that they need, whatever it may be. It's just not something that shows up for a couple of months and then fades out. Because that's a lot of that stuff does happen, unfortunately. Whereas, you know, and that's globally. We're going to be here for you for the next couple of months, and then things fizzle out. So it's just staying committed, I think, to it, and all the avenues that are involved in that we already kind of touched on. I hope I got.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. Yeah. That's awesome.
Do it. Follow through. Do it. Make sure it's there and invest.
Yeah. And it's not a short term. It's not a problem. Yeah, this is a long-term investment, like you talked
about. Yeah, I don't think 6 years you're saying later, is to throw all resources at it immediately, but to invest in something, you add a little bit all the time, and it grows with, you know, significant interest.
You know, we're a good example of what we evolved since then. You know, again, I'm mm-hmm. not...
Right. Every year, a little bit more. A little next bit thing more, you look just back, keeps growing. Like, we're pretty good at this. Yeah. Now, things are going to go... It's like you can train for a tornado coming through your town. Ain't nothing going to prevent you from watching the tornado going through your town. You're like, oh, this is going to suck.
It's like Mike Tyson said, everybody's got a plan until you get punched in the nose.
I think he said the mouth, but either way.
Bite your ear off.
Yeah, bite your ear off. Another thing. Yeah, then that whole plan goes out the window too. But before we close it out, why don't you give a shameless plug? Where can Please. People normally see you?
Go all ahead. Right. Well, we got a couple. It's called the Get Salty Experience Podcast.
There you go.
Is normally where I can be. We've had some good shows on there. We've actually made some impact, just so you guys know that are listening. We actually did a few mental health shows, one in particular with me and a few others that followed that are, again, we're spreading this message. So if you want to hear, have some good laughs and whatnot, but at the same time, you know, you could understand the message that's behind those podcasts. And there was a lot of information after those podcasts where people were reaching out that were happy to hear that somebody, I guess, of my career length that was speaking up and saying it's okay. So
you're paying it forward.
Paying it forward, and it yep. has helped them. So I'm hoping that here today we helped somebody.
Absolutely. You don't know it. You'll never know it, but I bet you there's somebody out there who you just helped today.
I hope so.
Absolutely.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you for coming on.
Thank you guys for having me.
No, thanks for coming.
Out there doing
it. Yeah, it's the old guys. The old 51-year-old guy.
Thank you, sir.
All right, man. That would have been bad.
Thank you for joining us in the Minds on the Frontline podcast. We hope everyone enjoyed this episode. We have more great content coming out soon. Please check us out on YouTube, Instagram, and Facebook, and make sure to like and subscribe to all Minds on the Frontline podcast social media channels. Thank you for listening, and have a great day.